Few years ago, there was a British mathematician by the name of Gompertz who came up with what he called the life cycle curve. And it looks pretty much like any other bell-shaped curve, almost. He said that we can locate on that curve every living thing that includes you and me. So he said in the beginning, there is birth. Then the next stage, I'll abbreviate this, is the struggle for survival. And then there is a period of growth. And then there comes a time that every living thing peaks out or reaches a plateau. Once the plateau has been reached, there is decline. And the final stage is death. Anytime that growth ceases, we've reached a peak. So while this perhaps should be the graph of your life and my life, if growth ceases, we peak at this point and go on down. So, a definition of death is death begins when growth ceases. Does that make sense? Now, what I would like for you to do is to locate yourself physically. Where are you physically? And I can give you a little hint. There's a couple of us in here that are over 33. If you're past 33 years of age, you have peaked out physically. And you're going downhill. And there's not much you can do about it. But that's already happened. Mentally, most of us hope to hang on a little bit longer than that. But we may or may not. So, locate yourself mentally. How far are you from being peaked out? But, spiritually, this curve does not apply. It does not apply to God. And every Christian should still be growing the day we die. Now, do you believe that about yourself? What's going to happen the day you stop growing? You start dying. Peek out down the hill. So I trust that every one of us will be an exception to the curve. And the day that we die, we'll still be growing, according to 2 Peter 3:18. Grow in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I went around and asked several of the staff members what they thought I should speak on tonight, and I got several ideas, and I couldn't put them all together, so this is one that came from one source. Now for the main subject of this evening. As I was coming in the gate tonight, coming up here, I met my friend Jim Peterson going out the gate. He's just in town for a couple of days, and I recalled a last time we were together, We were driving from several miles out over in this direction, and we're discussing Jim's manuscript that he had just completed. And I asked him what the title was going to be. So he gave several suggested titles, and I told him I didn't think any of them were too hot. So he said, "What would you suggest?" And I said, "I would suggest that you call this book The Unfinished Task and How to Finish It." And a few months later, I got a copy of the book through the mail called Evangelism as a Lifestyle. But I'm not going to give up. So tonight, I'm going to talk to you about The Unfinished Task and How to Finish It. And I'm going to seek some help from some of you. Jake, you read with a loud, resonant voice. I'm going to give you several verses one at a time. I'd like for you to read aloud from your translation. And the rest of you may follow if you want. Many of you have Chinese and Japanese Bibles. Several years ago, a friend of mine was talking with a great Chinese Christian, and he said, there's a lot of difference between the way that you Americans and English-speaking people look at the Bible and the way we do. And when we read the Bible, we say, we're like this. But when you read the Bible, you go like this. So, Jake, there's a pattern in these verses. As soon as somebody discovers it, why, speak up, please. Genesis 12:3 is the first one. Deuteronomy 2:25.
This very day I will begin to put the terror and fear of you on all the nations under heaven. They will hear reports of you and will tremble and be in anguish because of you.
Joshua 4:24. Now, these expressions, have you caught any common thread yet? What is it? All the earth, everybody on earth. Abraham, Moses, Joshua. Let's go to David. The last part of 1 Samuel 17:46. What follows that?
And then the battle begins.
That the battle began. Well,
36, I think, is the one you want.
Yeah, maybe so.
1 Samuel 17:46. I'm sorry. The whole world will know that there is a God in Israel. 46. I'm sorry.
David, his son Solomon, 1 Kings 8:60. Okay, 2 Kings 19:19. Hezekiah. These are representative of people throughout the Old Testament who got the message from God that he was interested in and wanted to bring the knowledge of himself to everyone on earth. Now there's one more we want to add to these. It is Jeremiah 22:29. I wish we'd have read that from another version. Yes, most of the versions say, "Oh, earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord." That's what the Authorized Version says. That's all right to use it occasionally. Now, maybe you've been a little oppressed and haven't had time to memorize many new verses this week, so we want to correct that right now. So, I'm going to say this once more, and then you repeat it after me. Jeremiah 22:29, "O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord." Jeremiah 22:29. Okay, let's say it together. Jeremiah 22:29, "O earth, 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 hear the word of the Lord." Jeremiah 22:29. Now, don't you feel better having memorized a verse today? In John chapter 17, which I'd like for you to open, we'll be referring, open your Bible to that, we'll be referring to it several times. We have the account of Christ's last night on earth. If repetition is a key as to what was on his heart that last night on earth, then we know what was on his heart. Because in that prayer, he mentioned the world 19 times. A few of those do not refer to the people of the world, but most of them do. Here in Colorado Springs, every August, some of you might have attended it this year that live here, we have a rodeo. And generally, some Hollywood star is brought in to help the crowds stay large. One year, Waldron Scott, that Paul knows real well, started our ministry in Lebanon, was home on furlough. He and I went to rodeo. The star that year, they turn out all the lights. He rides out on his white horse. They put the spotlights on him. And everybody wondered what he was going to do. So he said, "I'm going to sing." Although we thought he was a cowboy. And he sang a song that some of you might know. "He holds the whole world in his hand." No, wonderful song. Waldron Scott had never heard that song before. I think he thought it was original with Cliff Robertson, who was singing it. He turned to me and he said, "You know, he's almost got it right. He just needs to change a couple of words and sing, 'He holds the whole world in his heart.'" Well, that's the message. He's got the whole universe in his hand. And he's got the whole world on his heart. And he always has had it, as we saw throughout the Old Testament. The vision of reaching the world is not a New Testament idea. It is not a new idea. The unfinished task. The world still doesn't know. 2/3 of the world doesn't know. That's the unfinished task. But we want to look across on how to finish it. And now we want to get into John chapter 17. Nate, I'm sure you remember as well as I do the back in 1962 when you and I got on an airplane in Beirut and flew down to Jerusalem, which at that time was part of Jordan. And Nate and I did some sightseeing in the heat of the day. But I had a secret desire that I'd had ever since I'd been a Christian, and that was to go out in the Garden of Gethsemane, where Christ spent his last night on earth, and perhaps spend all night where he did. So Nate and I waited till it got dark and a little cool and hiked down into the Garden of Gethsemane. We thought we were going to have a real peaceful time, but some of the local vineyard's dogs gave us a bad time, but we stayed anyway. And we read together the accounts, read aloud. Each of us had a flashlight. Matthew, Mark, and Luke, of Christ's last night on earth. And then it seemed such a sacred moment that we separated a few yards to be away from each other just so we'd be alone. And I turned to John 17 and read that aloud under the flashlight. Up to this point, I think I had always felt, if I can put it this way, a little bit sorry for Christ. Now, he had put 33 years of his life in and apparently had very little to show for it. And I wondered, well, I always thought that he must have felt a little discouraged that night. But as I read John 17, I saw it in a completely different light. Christ was not disheartened. He was not discouraged. But in words of great triumph, he said in verse 4, I have brought you glory on earth by completing the work you gave me to do. Now, he obviously was not talking about the crucifixion. He said, at this point in time, I've completed the work you gave me to do. And as we read on, we see what that work was to result in. Verse 21, that the world may believe, and that the world may know. Verses 21 and 23. Can't you just see the triumph in his voice as he prayed to Father and said, I've gained glory to you by completing the work you gave me to do. The result of that is, it is now possible for all the world to know about you and about me. Now, I'm real interested in what that work was that he was talking about. It was not the crucifixion. So we look for clues, and we find the first one in verse 6, where he talks about those whom you gave me out of the world. Some of the other versions are not as modern. They say, the men you gave me out of the world. And then he said, next, verse 14, I have given them your word. So what was the work that he did that was going to result in the world knowing? I just took the people you gave me. I gave them the word that you gave me to give them. And then, as he looked into the future in verse 18, as you sent me into the world, I have sent them into the world. So that's a summary of what he was talking about, the work he finished. I just took the men you gave me. I gave them the word that you gave me to give them. I've sent them. Now, I'd like to review what happened in the next few years. and like to look first at Colossians chapter 1, verse 6. Somebody may have more light on these verses than I do, and if you do, I'd like you to help me with them. The subject in Colossians 1, 5, you see, is the word of truth, the gospel that has come to you. Now look what it says at the conclusion of verse 6. All over the world, this gospel is producing fruit and growing. This letter to the Colossians was written about 30 years after the resurrection. And he said, all over the world. That's what Christ had prayed, that the gospel, the message, would get all over the world. Paul wrote 30 years after the resurrection, the gospel is bearing fruit all over the world. Here at Glen Eyrie, I had a discussion group of some conferees several years ago, among which were two very well-known pastors from one of our cities south of here. And so I asked them, I said, what do you think that means? And one of them, I thought this was very interesting for a pastor to say. He said, well, I don't know what it means, but it certainly doesn't mean what it appears to mean. And the other said, well, it's very obvious that it means the Roman world, the local Mediterranean world. So I mopped my brow and said, I wish that I hadn't asked you that. Because I was going to refer next to Colossians 1:23, right across the page, where he said, this is the gospel that you have heard and that has been proclaimed to every creature under heaven. So I said, what do you think about that? And he gave a very good answer. He said, well, I'm not an astronomer, but I understand from people who are Christian astronomers that you can find the gospel written in the stars and the constellations. Well, maybe that's what it means. I don't know. But I kind of get the impression that the word got around in that next 30 years. Do you get that impression? Just one other example in Acts 19:10. Paul spent a few years in Ephesus, a little under 3 years, and he stayed in one place most of the time. It's not 10, it's the last verse in what is it? Yeah, what verse is that? Okay. Yeah. Okay. Everybody in the province of Asia heard the word. Now, you see how this fits together? Christ had the whole world on his heart. His last night on earth, he said to the Father, I've glorified you. I've finished the work. The result, which is that all the world may know. 30 years later, he was able to say that was true. John's gospel was written about 90 A.D. And many people have wondered why he did not emphasize the Great Commission the same way the other gospel writers did. So someone has suggested it had already been accomplished. He wouldn't emphasize something that had already been done. 200 years after Christ, a Roman scholar by the name of Tertullian wrote a series of letters to the Roman emperor. They've been put together in a book called Apologeticus, I believe it is. I don't have the exact quote with me. I generally carry it with me, but don't have it tonight. But in writing this letter to the emperor, he's chiding him for the treatment the Christians have been receiving. And he said, we're relatively new, but we're every place. In the forum, in the army, in the palace. He said, we're every place except in your heathen temples. You find Christians every place. Then he ended his letter by saying, the Roman Empire is much better off because of us. And he said, because nearly all of the citizens in nearly all of your cities are Christians. I checked this with my friend Walden Scott, who is somewhat of a historian, and he claims that the most widespread the gospel has ever been has been 13% of the world, that is, in the early generations. I said, how do you reconcile this? That almost all the people in almost all the cities are Christians. He said, well, I guess most of the people lived in the country. But I tell you, there was a great movement in that first 30 years. There are principles that apply today that are not being practiced. And, you know, this is kind of what the Navigators are all about. We would like to analyze just a little deeper why that fantastic response to the gospel, what's behind it. Can it be duplicated? If it can, we have the answer to the unfinished task and how to finish it. Now, I'm going to have to condense this because I want to get to the point. Christ had the 12 in a program, training program. And one of these days when I'm up in heaven, I'm going to corner one of the 12. I don't know which one it'll be. Not Peter. He can out-talk me. But I'm going to say, I understand that you were in a training program with Christ. And, well, you might call it that. So, well, now in our programs, many of our countries, that university students go about 9 months out of the year. How many months out of the year were you in this training program? 12. Oh, in many of our universities, we have classes 5 days a week. How many days a week did you have classes? 7. Well, we go to class from maybe 7:30 in the morning to 1:30 in the afternoon, something like that. What hours were you under training? 24. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 12 months out of the year, 3.5 years. Sometime you might find an interesting Bible study, as I have, to take all the events that are related in the Bible about Christ and assign a time factor to them. What did he do with his time? Do you know that you can't account for 90% of his time? Everything that's recorded took less than 10% of his time. But if you had asked the 12 where that other 90% went, they would tell you about the 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days out of the year. Now, I can't document every point. I'm going to have to jump ahead. What did he do? Ask one of the 12. What did he do during that time? Give me a summary of what he did. And I believe if we interviewed all 12 of them, we'd come up with this composite. He imparted knowledge to us. He imparted skill to us. And he imparted character to us. As a result of that, We went out, as one version says, turned the world upside down. Now, as I use these three words, knowledge, skill, and character, what's the difference? I want to try to explain this with an illustration. Now, I'm going to assume that every one of you is a team leader. Maybe that's a wrong assumption, but you place yourself, stretch up another foot, lift up your chin and say, I'm a team leader. Or you're a team leader, just for tonight. And you feel that the team you're leading is not doing enough personal evangelism. So, you rack your brain, how are we going to correct this? And you say, oh, I know. I'm going to hold some classes in how to do personal evangelism. So you make out a curriculum. And you find out how to categorize people and what scripture to use to meet the needs of each one of them. You know, the indifferent and the self-righteous and the too great a sinner and everybody you can think of. You find out by meeting an hour a week, this is going to take 6 months to cover your curriculum. So you tell the team, we're going to set aside 1 hour every Thursday, go through personal evangelism. So you teach them all these techniques, verses and so forth. And at the end of the 6 months period, you give everybody a diploma, showing that he's a graduate in how to do personal evangelism. Do you think the amount of personal evangelism which is being done will increase very much? Well, perhaps so. But statistically, people who've done this, not much. Now, let's say that you as a team leader took a different approach. And the first night, now you've still held all the classes, but the first night of class, you looked out for the person who was most responsive and seemed to be following you. And after the meeting, you said, what are you doing tomorrow night? Well, no matter, cancel it. I'm going to show you my list of prospects, the people I'm praying about. And I'm going to show you how I make an appointment. And then I'm going to show you how I open the conversation, how I deal with their objections, and if they're responsive, how I lead them to Christ. So, you do that Friday night. And then the next week, you do it again. So all the time you're teaching on Thursday night, you're doing this on Friday night. So after the third week, fourth week coming up, is then the next Friday when we get together, you show me your list. And we'll call up somebody on that list and make an appointment. So you do that. The sixth week, you say, I'm not going to do anything but go with you. And if you've got all the answers, I won't even speak up. So that's the way it works out after the sixth week. You've taught him or her well. So at the end of the sixth week, you say, now tomorrow, or next Thursday after class, I'm going to get so-and-so, and you get so-and-so. And we'll start all over again. I'll take him, you take another. At the end of 6 months, how many people would be doing personal evangelism? Now, maybe it's too late at night to figure it out. But there'd be a few, wouldn't there? Now, what have you done? You've added skill to knowledge. Knowledge alone is necessary, but not enough. Knowledge and skill. Now, Saturday morning, after this friend of yours has gone out alone the first time, you ring him on the phone, say, how'd it go last night? And he tells you all about it. And you do this Saturday after Saturday after Saturday. So one day, when you call him up, how'd you do last night? He's all ready for you. Or she's all ready for you. And whether it's a he or a she, they say, you know, when you first started calling me up, I thought you were genuinely interested in what I did. And I think you were, but no more. All you're doing is checking up on me. Make sure I went out Friday night. He said, I've got news for you. You don't have to check up on me anymore. I've got the same motivation that you've got. You have imparted character also to them. So that's when the job's done, when character's been imparted. This is what I think Paul is expressing in Galatians 4:19, where he says, my dear children, for whom I am again in the pains of childbirth, until Christ is formed in you. And what he was saying, I think, is that the pain of birth is just the beginning. And follow-up and growth, it has to be repeated many, many times. So, we ask the 12, what did Christ do during that intensive 3.5 years? He imparted knowledge. He imparted skill. And he imparted character. And if you have time sometime to read Fox's Book of Martyrs, take the account of how all 12 came to the end of their life. Only John died a natural death. They had that character that went out. Now I'd like to talk just a minute on a principle that Christ demonstrated and that became a technique with Paul. I think that we can't copy directly from Christ because of his great resources, but Paul we can again use for a role model. There's a fascinating verse in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2 and verse 11. And the first time I understood this verse, I laughed out loud. Maybe that wasn't very reverent. I read it in a version that came out a few years ago called the New English Translation. And I think there are people who felt that when that translation was published that the Navigators had a lobbyist in there. In the NIV it reads, for you know how we dealt with each of you as the father deals with his own children. The Amplified Version says, we dealt with you as the father deals with his own children personally, doing this. But this New English Version said, I dealt with you as a parent deals with his own children one by one. And that's when I laughed out loud. Now I'll tell you why. We were in the midst of bringing up our family of 7. And I thought, now, how far ahead I would have been to have kept a detailed diary when the first one was born. You know, every hour. 9 o'clock, you do this. 10 o'clock, you do this. Right on through. Then, when the next one's born, you just lay the book out there. And whatever time it is, you do that. You do that. Sandy, wouldn't that work real well? Yeah. Oh, you don't think it would work? Why wouldn't it work? Now, there's no two have the same need at the same chronological age. there are no two Christians which have the same need at the same chronological age. So, if we deal with our physical children one by one, how much more important it is to deal with our spiritual children one by one. Several years ago, I had a friend while I was still in the Navy, a naval officer, who was a fine Christian, a good speaker, Bible teacher. And he told me one day, he said, you people, the navigators, waste too much time. He said, when I speak, I want all the people I can get. When I teach, I want the biggest crowd I can get. I don't have time to teach one, preach to one or two. But, he said, there's something I don't understand. He said, yours seem to stick, and mine don't. I never do see them again after that, but yours hang around. Why? Same content. What I teach is what you teach. Then I told him, I said, well, Hal, you're a jet pilot. Now, I'm going to rehearse for you your jet training. And as long as I'm telling the truth, why, you affirm. But if I get off the track, why, then you correct me. So I described the first 9 months in ground school, all the things he went through. And I said, finally, one day, after about 15 months, your instructor, who'd been lecturing to you all these months, said, well, gentlemen, the great day has arrived. There are 15 of you in the class. There are 15 jet trainers out there on the runway. Now, each one of you, go crawl in one. I want to see how you do. He said, no. That's not the way it worked. I said, how did it work? And he got a big frown on his face. And he said, that officer that trained me, he said, he was on my back from early in the morning to night. He said, you'll never learn to fly. You're going to kill both of us. I could tell that it was a very unpleasant experience that he was recalling. So I said, now, Hal, you're a lieutenant junior grade in the Navy. I know the Navy's got a lot of money, but are you telling me that they assigned a lieutenant commander and his whole duty was just to teach you to fly? He said, yeah. Personally, he was with me all the time, correcting, helping me. But he'd already gotten the point. I said, Hal, let me tell you something else. You can evaluate the importance of the job by the amount of personal, individual training that goes into it. How long do you think it takes to train an elevator operator? How long? Tell me. Now, this says up, this says down, this says close the door, and one means the first floor, two means the second floor. What does it take? Half hour? How long does it take to train a jet pilot? You can tell how important the task is by the amount of personal individual training that goes into it. Now let me ask you this. Is there anything more important than training a Christian to reproduce? Do you know of any more important task? I don't. If any task deserves some personal individual attention. This task does more than any other task in the world. Well, when this job is done right, it results in the next generation doing the same thing. There are many businesses in every country in the world where that the son takes over from the father and is successful, and then his son takes over. It may not be because he has a great aptitude for that, but he's had months and years of being trained personally so that he can do it. In the Navigators, we talk quite a bit about generations. The word multiply in the New Testament, as we've studied it down through the years, we've concluded it means to greatly increase the number. And in this first 30 years I'm talking about, there's several accounts in the book of Acts, four of them, in fact, that talks about the number greatly increasing. Now, I've never done this before. I'm going to put something on the board that I hope will illustrate it. My wife and I, as you met last night, have seven children. If each one of them have one children, we will have seven grandchildren. And if each one of these have one, we'll have seven great-grandchildren. Is that right? So at the end of four generations, there will be, 23 of us. Now, I do not consider that that is greatly increasing the number. While, if, I don't necessarily recommend this, but this is just an illustration, you understand. But you do know what the first commandment of the Bible is, don't you? It's to be fruitful and multiply. I told somebody that once, and he said, yeah, it goes on to say, be fruitful and multiply and replenish the earth. But it didn't say you had to do it all by yourself. Well, here's the two of us up here. Suppose that each one of our children duplicate what their parents did. How many grandchildren will there be? Is that right? And if each one of those grandchildren do what their parents and grandparents did, how many will there be? Now, if the next generation catches on, how many will there be? That's what I call greatly increasing. All we have to do is duplicate what our parent did. Now, I know as a parent that physically children are pretty sensitive about bugging them all the time about grandchildren. And you really don't have too much control in the natural realm. But spiritually, you've got a right and a duty, I think, to do everything possible to see that your children produce grandchildren and great-grandchildren and so on down the line to greatly increase. You folks that are visitors to the United States, you've probably run across a home products sales organization called Amway. Have you heard of it? Back sitting out here in the laundry room, that's the kind of soap out there, Amway. Well, this is a great marketing scheme. And, you know, it's a, they call it a pyramid method, where that you don't just sell soap, but you recruit two other people to sell soap. And then they recruit four more. And they recruit eight more. And you get part of the profit back. So you don't try to make your money selling soap. You recruit people to sell soap. Against my will, attended one of these meetings one night. It wasn't advertised as one of those meetings. And one of the slides that they showed was a man down at the Cotton Bowl in Dallas, Texas, having a convention of 25,000 people that were all in his pyramid. All 25,000 are there because of him. Well, he was getting a kickback out of every cent he earned, and so he could give them this big convention. Well, I'm sure you see what I'm talking about. That the unfinished task will be completed when people start greatly increasing. Nate said that I ought to give some war stories and some examples. And, you know, that they are so numerous that I just, it was hard to be selective. But I thought about one I just learned about a few months ago. Several years ago, when I was in the Navy as a captain of a ship out in the Philippines, I'd only been out there a few days, and I went to visit some Christians, and they treated me like a celebrity. You know, I just, naval officer came in, and called on me to do this and do that. And I didn't know what this was all about till one of them said, you know, that was a great article that Dawson Trotman wrote for our magazine about you. I didn't know anything about any article for any magazine, but it got out there before I did, just a few days. And here I happened to show up, and as I say, I was a miniature celebrity. Well, that article he wrote for the Far East Gospel Mission, it was later put in a tract. And he just told the story of my life, how I reached a man by the name of Kenny Waters, and he reached a man by the name of Don Rosenberger, and he reached another, and on down. He was just illustrating what that point. And he happened to pick me out. Well, this last year back in Washington, and by the way, a part of my ministry is with a group called the Fellowship. And the head of this is a man by the name of Doug Coe. They're the people who put on the presidential prayer breakfast in Washington and have breakfasts all over the world, 140 countries. Well, it happened to Don Rosenberger, who was the third man mentioned, was at the meeting last year. And he called a meeting of a bunch of people in a special room and asked me if I would attend. So I was able to show up for a little bit. And he introduced me to a man by the name of Roy Cook that he had led to Christ. And then Roy Cook introduced to me to a man by the name of Doug Coe that he had led to Christ. And here the man that when I'm with this organization is my boss. You know, I never knew that until this year. It just goes on and on, you know, Waters, Rosenberger, Cook, Coe. And then he's exploded like Dawson Trotman has exploded all over the world. Jake, I was trying to think. I think it was back in the early 60s out in Singapore that we had this conference down on the beach. And one of the things we did was took pictures of generation groups. And it seemed like there were seven or eight of them in that conference. You remember that? And the interesting thing was they were all teenagers. So we had all these pictures of seven or eight groups. And this man had led this into Christ, who had led this into Christ, who had led this into Christ. Generations, spiritual generations, about 50 people, all of them less than 20 years of age. So the examples are very, very numerous. But the answer to the unfinished task is to greatly increase. Dawson Trotman was very practical and observing. He said, the world will be populated spiritually the same way it is populated physically. Every generation greatly multiplies. At the time of Christ, the population of the earth was 250 million. It took from the time of Christ until the year 1840 AD for the first billion people to be on earth. From 1840 until 1980, 140 years later, we are approaching 5 billion. Many people have been born since 1840, four times as many as there were in all of history before that. That is greatly increasing through a physical process of each generation, greatly increasing. Spiritually, it's the same. Well, I'm about finished, but I got to expound a favorite topic on the unfinished task, how to finish it. I'd like to ask one question. When do you think God will be totally happy? I think he'll be happy if and when everybody on earth is in his family. When everybody's been converted, God's happy. Now, in order to get people converted, we've got to have disciples, haven't we? But disciples are not an end in themselves. The end is they'll get people converted. Now, in order to have disciples, you have to have disciple makers. They're not an end in themselves. Disciple makers should make disciples so they can make converts, so God's purpose will be accomplished. In order for disciple makers to be function the most efficiently, you've got to have some leadership to lead the disciples makers. And then when you get many nationalities all over, then you got to have some leaders to lead them. Then you got to have some leaders to lead them and so forth. So there's a place for everybody in this generation business, in this greatly increasing. Well, disciples are desperately needed. Disciple makers are desperately needed. Leaders of disciple makers are desperately needed. But you, if you're not operating in one of these categories, well, what should I say? You should be by tomorrow. If you're not, you should. There's a place for you, a vital place, in finishing a unfinished task. I've got two more things to say, about 2 minutes. How many of you know how much longer you've got to serve Christ? You know? You write it down? No, I don't think you know. I think there was only one person who began his ministry, who knew how long he had. And who was that? That was Christ. He knew he had 3.5 years. He had to choose a plan that would be successful the first time. There's a story I've heard that perhaps you've heard, that when Christ got back to heaven, people gathered around him, or whoever, whatever you call them, people live in heaven, citizens up there, and said, now, what's your plan for perpetuating what you've begun? He said, well, I took 12 men. And one of them said, well, one of them's already bombed out. And Peter, he kind of went over him. He said, what's plan B? Christ said, I don't have any other plan. No plan B. That's the plan. He knew it would work. And it did work. And I think reasoning, logic would tell us today that the reason that we're not seeing the same results in our generation that were seen in the first generation is because we are not following the same principles that were operating in the first generation. Well, I'm going to close with something. I was in a meeting once where a man who had never heard of the Navigators, because I had dinner with him later to see if he had, made a statement. As he gave some world statistics, gave his message, he stood up and boomed out these words that I'm going to leave with you. It's too late to add. Go out and multiply.